you very much. Welcome everybody to the Select Committee on the Petition in the Court and Assembly Chambers this morning. I'd like to open the session with the consideration of oral evidence. So first off, we have the Youth Parliament. I'm not sure whether or not the names on here are in the order that you'd like to come up, but if you'd like to just come up in the order that you prefer, then give your oral evidence, and then give an opportunity for members to ask you any questions as well afterwards. So the first person would like to step forward, please, if you'd like to just say your name as well for the record. Thank you. I think we've got someone that needs to switch their microphone off.
Sounds like Mark.
Right, I think that's all right. Thank you very much.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Alexia Davis, and I'm one of the many Youth Parliament representatives here today. I would like to start off with a huge thank you to everyone for giving us the opportunity to come here today. We all share the common belief that the voices of young people across the island should be heard, and it means everything to us to be able to stand here, today and represent the youth community of the Falklands when it comes to thoughts on the internet. I'd now like to present my Youth Parliament peers, Ramiz Rao, Harry Lockley, Aaron Komoto, Micah Joseph Hersey, and Daniel Lee. They'll be coming up in that order.
Good morning. It is no secret the internet is a problem here in the Falklands, but I think to get a better understanding of the internet quality that Shore is providing us, we need to talk about the internet speed. On September the 1st, Shore announced a new upgrade to the internet packages. Each package offers more data, and Shore even added two unlimited packages, one slower than the other, which Shore on their website has claimed to apparently reach speeds of 10 and 15 megabits per second respectively. However, in reality, those speeds are most certainly not the case. My household uses the 15 megabits per second package, and I rarely get speeds above 4 megabits per second. Perhaps it may vary from household to household, but I think we all know that Shore are not delivering on their claims. In fact, they are not even close. However, let's imagine this upgrade was an improvement. Let's imagine the internet did become a little faster than last time. Well, even if that was the case, this is just Shore's plan for the long term. As long as they keep making these small, incremental improvements, they will survive. The reason behind this is that when an upgrade comes around, people gain a little bit of happiness, perhaps even some excitement. But over time, that all goes away when people realize it is still very poor internet, and then complaints come around again and tensions rise. So what does Shore do? They just make another, small, incremental upgrade to yet again temporarily satisfy everyone. This cannot continue. And with slow internet comes problems, lots of problems. And before I hand it over to my peers, I will start by addressing one of the first issues, leisure. Things like streaming videos on platforms such as YouTube and Netflix, gaming on a console, or even just browsing the internet is extremely slow. When watching a video, it's not surprising when it buffers or at times doesn't even load at all. In fact, on a movie night with my family, before watching anything, we go around the house, make sure all of the devices' internet connections are off. Don't even get me started on online gaming. For the most part, online gaming becomes practically impossible to do with how laggy it is, and any updates would take days. I will now pass it over to Harry.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Good morning. My name is Harry Lockley. Broadband prices, as you all may know, are expensive, however are too high and at a cost which is inaccessible for many. The previous Shure packages were extremely frustrating with limited quotas, slow speeds and at an expensive price. However, we had no other option but to pay a high cost for a limited service. Starlink is the only alternative option, however even this has been made inaccessible for most with its large VSAT license cost. This creates a barrier to getting affordable good service. Shure has recently launched new packages which may be ideal for some, however yet again has left people with illegal but costly service, with the only unlimited options at an extremely high price, with low speeds when the rest of the world is moving forward. Although this was progress, many believe it was well overdue, and I'd agree. For such a high price, you may be looking for some bonus features. Instead, you have 5GB data caps at hotspots each month, and speeds which definitely underserve the promised speeds. This creates a barrier for customers and businesses paying an expensive service fee to utilising these packages. Proper connection and solutions such as Starlink are the future and are designed to connect remote places like the Falkland Islands at a reasonable price and to allow them to access the technology of today. Services like this provide high speeds, unlimited quotas, a customizable service at a much lower cost. Providing regulatory approval and reducing or abolishing the license fee is crucial for people to access better services now and break the current barrier to accessing and utilising the technology of the future and today.
Thank you very much indeed.
Good morning. My name is Erin Komoto. Today I'm going to talk about how the internet is crucial in the context of interviews and college applications. In this digital age, the internet is no longer just a tool for entertainment or casual browsing. It has become an essential platform for communication, work, and education. One of the most critical areas where internet access plays a vital role is in interviews. Whether you're applying for an internship, a part-time job, or even a full-time position after graduation. Virtual interviews have become the norm. More than ever, employers and educational institutions are relying on online platforms for face-to-face conversations, eliminating geographical barriers and making it easy to connect with candidates from all over the world. However, what happens if your internet is unstable? A poor connection can disrupt the flow of an interview, cause misunderstandings, or worse, lead to the perception that you're unprepared or unprofessional. Imagine losing audio or video during a key moment in your interview, or even being dropped from the meeting entirely. It can easily derail what could have been a great opportunity to make a lasting impression. Now let's talk about college applications. In the current academic landscape, many universities and colleges are using online platforms to manage applications. Students submit essays, academic transcripts, and letters of recommendation through online portals. They also schedule interviews and even complete virtual campus tours. The reliance on the internet in these processes is undeniable. But poor or inconsistent internet access can be devastating. Imagine missing a crucial deadline for submitting an application or experiencing a technical issue while uploading a personal statement. Something as simple as a dropped connection can result in a missed opportunity that could affect your educational career. This brings us to a larger issue, how internet access is linked to educational equity. In many areas, especially in camp, people of older ages who want to complete further education do not have access to reliable internet. This digital divide creates an unfair disadvantage for them who are otherwise qualified for these opportunities, but simply do not have the technological resources to compete on a level playing field. In a world where education and employment are increasingly intertwined with the digital space, access to reliable internet has become more than just a convenience, it's a necessity. Imagine the potential for growth, the vast amount of knowledge, and the connections that students can build when they have access to stable internet. On the other hand, think about the doors that are unintentionally closed when that access is limited or unreliable. It's not just about having internet access, it's about having adequate high-speed and stable internet access to ensure students can compete fairly and succeed in their academic and professional journey. In conclusion, reliable internet is not just a convenience. It is an essential part of modern education and career building. Poor internet connectivity can drastically affect both interviews and college applications, and by extension, it affects students' futures. As we advocate for better education, let's advocate for better infrastructure that supports all students equally, ensuring that no one is left behind because of something as simple yet vital as internet access. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
My name is Micah Joseph Hersey, and I'd like to present why I think education and internet are very why our internet can affect our education. I believe that our time in Year 11 is one of the most important years of our lives, and is a big deciding factor in where our lives continue from here. So I believe it is important that we get the most amount of support and time to ensure we achieve the most we can. In this day and age, the majority of our homework is online. Recently, we've all been receiving piles upon piles of homework, of online and paper homework, and with extremely slow internet, it is making an already long process to an unnecessarily longer process. Although we understand that as you get older and more mature, the quantity of the homework becomes larger and the quality of the homework becomes harder, we are still adapting to this, and the slow internet increasing the time we spend on homework is only adding insult to injury. I would also like to add that you guys have whitelisted more of our education websites, which we appreciate. However, doing this has brought to light that the slow speeds of the internet is also preventing us from taking full advantage of these benefits from using these websites. Another important reason I believe we would benefit from faster and more reliable internet is the fact that our homework is cutting into our sleep schedule. For example, I have 4 pieces of homework due today and had to stay up significantly later than I normally would just to get it done, when I should have been resting in preparation for this meeting. The only reason I hadn't done it earlier in the week is because I had pieces of homework due every single day of the week. I may have been able to do this earlier in the week, but the internet speed prevented me from getting onto the Seneca website for approximately half an hour, which forced me to stay up later than necessary. We've all had to sacrifice the majority of our social lives outside of school to revise and do homework, so I don't think we should have to sacrifice our sleep as well. Before I let one of my peers make their points, I would like to share my final point, communication. Although my peer Ramiz has slightly touched on this, I would like to share my views from a personal standpoint. As someone who has lived in Stanley for only 3 years and spent 12 years of their life in the UK, I gained many friends over my time there, and I believe it is important to check on them and keep in contact with them. Although I get very little chance to actually talk to them right now, I do cherish the brief moments and brief moments a week I get to speak to them. But the poor internet quality makes it almost unbearable, as they always responded to me about 6 seconds after I've said something. Sometimes they'll hear me once the topic has already changed, which at that point I might as well not be there. I'm hoping that Starlink will be able to solve these issues and the issues that my peers have also raised. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Hello. So, ladies and gentlemen, with the issues we have presented to the committee, we ask for someone to act to make the changes necessary to switch to Starlink and finally allow the students to get what they need and want. We understand that the topic of the internet has been a sensitive topic for a long time, and we understand it's not an overnight solution. But enough is enough, and work must be continued to ensure this goal we all have in mind is achieved. Thank you for allowing us to speak to you today and listening to us in return.
Thank you very much to Daniel. Thank you to all of you, actually, for coming in and being brave enough to come and give us your thoughts for the future. I'll just go round and ask if there are any questions, perhaps.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I was going to ask the process for taking questions, seeing as you've all sat down. I'd first like to recognise that I think your testimony, each individually, was incredibly powerful. And thank you for putting the time aside to come today. I think, Micah, you were touching on there in particular the damage that it has on your personal relationships, and something that was touched by both yourself and by Ramiz was the impact that it has on your family as well. So I wonder if I can ask a question as to how does it affect your family dynamic if you're all working to a limited quota package? Because I can imagine that you have to then dedicate time to talk to your friends in the UK, but then you're also thinking about, you know, not breaching that monthly quota. So does that affect your family dynamic and how, and yeah, the relationships that you have at home?
Slightly, because obviously, it's, you know, speaking to them will, you know, already slow it down for everyone else. So we sort of need to take it in turns, you know, who's going to go on at what time. But and then, or even then, I don't get a lot of time to speak to them because I'm always, you know, just, you know, either doing homework or revising. So, you know, although I don't get a lot of time to speak to them in the first place, but then I need to let my mother and my brother also to have their time on the internet, which is also, you know, preventing my time on going on. So it's very minuscule amount of time I actually do get to speak to them.
Thank you. That does help enlighten it somewhat, because I can imagine as you get nearer the end of the month, it becomes more of an issue for you as a family dynamic. Thank you.
Gavin, do you have
No, mine was just going to be perhaps a statement more than anything else. I'd like to thank, obviously, the you all for coming in today and for giving evidence. And to be honest with you, I don't think it's something I could have done even at your age. I'd have got far too nervous. But the two things really that's come out from what has been said, Chair, is basically the need for speed and price. So I thank you for highlighting those, and I do note your comments.
I don't have any specific questions, but I'd like to thank you all for the your presentations and the high quality and detail that you put in those. And you touched upon the fact that you're, one way or another, you're pressured into nocturnal time in order to get the full benefits or adequate benefits from the internet system. This has been a problem for some years with the only adequate or getting on for adequate periods being in the late hours when people like you should be getting your rest. Thank you.
Jack, and then we're going. Jack?
I don't think I have anything further to add other than all the...
John?
No, neither do I, but thank you very much for coming. Everybody spoke really well, and it's more difficult than many people think. And the points that everybody made, I think, are very valid. Thank you again.
Mark, I don't know if you can... I can't see you at all, so I'm not sure if you're raising your hand or you're there.
Thanks, Roger. Just like to thank them for their comments. My dealings with the Youth Parliament always amaze me with how eloquent and on point they are, and today was no different. So thank you all for coming. I don't have any further questions.
And Leona, I think, was going to try and join us. Has she joined yet?
Not yet.
Tess, you had.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Chair. I did have a couple.
She has literally just picked up her computer from me, so hopefully she should be on ready now.
Okay.
Thank you, Mark. I did have a couple more questions. Sorry, I should have announced that at the beginning. The first one was to you, Erin, because you were talking specifically around the impact that it has on education and on your job interview opportunities. But I also kind of you touched on areas about how this may limit opportunities for the young people of the Falklands in the future. I was just really to, if you could, offer a view as to whether that impacts your mental health in any way, if that, not necessarily for you, but for your peers, if you know of any stories of how those pressures, and obviously meeting college deadlines from my recollection, you know, those things can be quite high pressure situations. So does it add any extra impact onto you all as individuals?
Yeah, I would believe so, especially since... let's say you've, for some reason, you've only been able to submit your personal statement just the day before. It's like due, and for some reason, it's taking hours upon hours to actually be submitted. And then you wake up the next day and you realize, oh, it's not been submitted. Then you would be very stressed because you would have just lost your position to go to college, meaning you would have to wait a whole another year again to reapply. So I think it would add a lot of stress, and it would really affect your mental health, because then you would have to try and rearrange things, especially if you had booked like accommodation or whatever. In that way, then that way you'd have to take a step back and just redo everything all over again.
Thank you very much. Sorry, that's a bit of an extra question, but I did think your testimony was very powerful. Thank you for sharing. I think my other question was probably addressed a little bit within some of the submissions, but a more general, I don't know who would want to take it necessarily, was around, do you feel that it doesn't only like limit your opportunity for say job interviews and college education interviews, but do you feel that you have a full access to employment opportunities with the internet in its current state, or do you think that there are any opportunities that you think, does it limit you to in any way? I'm not sure if anyone wants to take that. Or I think you did address it a little bit in your submissions, but if anyone has anything extra to say, welcome it. I can see Daniel waiting to go. Do you feel like that's...
I can try and answer.
Yeah. Because there's obviously quite a lot of jobs that you need to be online to be able to participate for, and certainly maybe that's a growing trend. Is that something that concerns you?
Yeah, I agree with what my peer said, that the internet speed and quality fluctuates during interviews quite a lot, and most of them have to be set up at the college in a consistent kind of live stream, and I feel like although it worked while I was there, I haven't heard stories from my other peers yet. I believe that it could still be better, because when I was talking to I believe her name was Sally at the college yesterday, she periods where her face would stop moving, it would be a little buffer, and I felt like I was being rude to her because I'd speak, and because of the delay, I'd butt in right for her right in the middle of a like sentence. So that was obviously, you know, pretty terrifying.
No, it's not ideal at all. Mm. Thank you very much for all of the evidence and for taking the questions. Oh, there's a few more people who'd like to say something. By all means, do come up. Yeah.
I would just like to add something from like personal experience when it comes to jobs and like the internet. In my house, my mum has her own business, which, you know, it's amazing having your own business. But one of our main problems in our house is the fact that my mum's business runs mainly online. So, for example, on the 13th of this month, we were already at 50% of our internet just from my mum having to use it for her business to generate an income for our family. So that adds, like, you know, a lot of pressure, especially because I, like, it feels like I can't do my, like, certain homeworks because, for example, I'm an art student, and for art, you have to do a lot of artist research or research on general history of art. And for those websites, it still uses the internet from your package. It's not one of the, you know, websites that don't use your package internet. So it's a lot of pressure. My brother can't, you know, play games because he's, you know, obsessed with that as well. So from personal experience, I would say the internet's a major problem for people that have small businesses, but even big, you know, large businesses, because they are quite expensive packages as well. A lot of families can't afford to get two different packages, so that one can be for the family and the other one can be for the business. So, yeah, that's...
Thank you, Alexia. That's a really powerful example.
Thank you very much. Leona, I notice, is online. Leona, would you like to say anything? Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair, and firstly, my apologies. I literally just got in from the airport, so I'm sorry that I missed the beginning. I'm particularly sorry, obviously, that I missed the Youth Parliament's submission, but I would just like to thank them. From the little bit that I saw there, it looks like that was really helpful. But yeah, I've got no questions at this point. Thank you.
I
think Erin wanted to make a contribution.
Please, yes, please do.
Just to add on with like the internet being slow. So, in school we do like the CAT4 tests. So, like what teachers have to do just to make sure that the website is set up in time, so we don't waste like 30 minutes waiting for it to load. They have to like log into all the computers for us and put in like all of our names, so then that way we can sign in. But even after we sign in, we still have to wait for like another 20 minutes for the website to load, and then on top of that we have to try and complete our CAT4 tests before the lesson ends. So it just kind of adds pressure, especially if like you're trying to achieve a higher reading age, you're kind of being rushed into completing it because of the limited time we have. And also with like Apat College, some people do like online courses here. So I've heard a lot of people saying that it's so much harder, especially since the internet is slower and it takes them longer to actually complete a course.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you all for making a very compelling case as to why the monopoly that we have created is not actually meeting the needs and aspirations of the younger generation. Certainly we've heard from other people as well, but certainly from your generation, it's really interesting. You are the future leaders of the Falklands, and it's really interesting to hear your views on the adequacy of the current situation. So thank you all very, very much for coming this morning and sitting in front of us all. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks. Thanks. Okay, shall we move on to Simon? Yes, the Attorney General. Thanks. Thanks very much, Simon. Good. Thank you. Okay. Right. Good. So, did you want to say anything before we started at all, Simon, or are you just happy to take questions as...
No, I think it's probably best if... I know members have got a number of questions, okay. So I think it's probably better if we move to questions.
Okay, so if we go round, perhaps if we start with Mark, do you want to ask the first question?
Certainly, thank you very much, and thank you, Simon, for coming and offering evidence at the Select Committee. My first question is about the sort of profitability and market dynamics, if I may. So I'd like to get the regulator's view on the potential impact of reducing or abolishing the ESAT's licence fee on Shaw's overall profitability model. And is there any evidence that's been gathered to support any findings? And also just a sort of addendum, if I may, and that's whether or not there's any mechanism through which the claims of high profit margins for Shaw can be publicly verified or not. Right, there's quite a few in there, so I'm happy to repeat that if it's needed.
No, I think you understand the questions that have been asked. I mean, I think in terms of has from a regulatory perspective, has there been analysis of the impact of lowering the fee? I think the answer is no. In terms of looking at detailed information, however, I think most people would accept that the provision of some of the services required under Shaw's universal service obligations is not economic without cross-subsidy from other services. And in the case of the broadband services that are offered, I think there's also effectively subsidy from the larger packages down to the smaller packages. I think it's worth remembering that the smallest internet package offered by Shaw costs £15 a month, which is actually lower than it was in 2015. And the data allowances have increased by something like 14 times since then. And I think it's really interesting listening to some of the submissions from the Youth Parliament. I think Ms. Komoto, I think it was, mentioned the issue of digital divide. And I think that is an important issue for members to consider. And I think bearing in mind that I think most of Shaw's customers in terms of internet packages are on packages medium and below. And some of those packages, based on the costs of Starlink, as they've sort of indicated, if people are on extra small and medium packages because that is all they can afford, then it is very unlikely that they will be able to afford to transition to an offering from Starlink, for example, even if members were ultimately to abolish the fee entirely. If it was reduced to the £180 that I think the petition refers to, I think that would still mean that someone on a medium package would very slightly pay more per year than they currently do. So again, anyone who is on a marginal sort of income in terms of their internet subscriptions, I think they'd have real difficulty there. But I think that is, you know, it is one of the issues that I think the government would need to grapple with. Yeah.
There's a fantastic amount of noise coming from the online participants. Can I just ask you to remind everyone to silence their microphones when they're sitting in your participating?
Okay. Simon, do you want to?
Yeah, and so I think the only other thing is, you know, obviously if the current VSAT license fee was abolished, then I do think a significant number of customers certainly would be, you know, able to switch over to another service, and it would either be cheaper for them to do so, or at least broadly the same cost. Now, that, without doing any detailed analysis, that is bound to have, I would suggest, a significant impact on Shure's ability to continue to deliver all of the services in all of the areas that they're currently required to deliver those services.
So just in response to your point on affordability, I thought the testimony of Mr. Rao earlier quite clearly outlined that it's not just about affordability, it's also about speed for, and whether you get the speed that is meant to be delivered with paying for the larger packages. So he outlined an example that his family was struggling to be able to achieve the 15 megabyte per second speed that was associated with the upgrade on their package. Yeah. And in fact, it was around 4. So I would also, it'd be difficult to discern whether there was a reluctancy from the public to pay for a larger package, which still delivered the same low speed and was perceived to be a poor quality for the higher price. So it's difficult to discern that without more data. But I would also stress that if we were to have more competition in the market, it certainly is a trend that would hope to create more affordable and better products. But those were points that were raised in the oral evidence and the written evidence that had been submitted. So just to counter that view about it all being about the affordability of Starlink versus Shure.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I suppose there's a number of points in there. One, this is a contended service, so, you know, the more people who are using services both within a household and across the community, you know, it has an impact on the speeds that can be achieved. Also, the infrastructure that's in place is different in different parts of the town, for example, and different parts of camp, and that will definitely, I'm sure, have an impact. Yeah.
Can I just add there, Simon, the Cartesian report, the 2015 yeah. Cartesian report, said Shure's EBITDA margin increased from 44% in 2012 to 48% in 2013, which is significantly higher than the benchmarked operators, ranging between 13 and 41%. Now, those benchmark operators weren't necessarily operating in a monopoly position.
Yeah.
The analysis of Shure Southwest Atlantic, and that obviously includes their other territories, so we can't draw too many. We need to have the information on the operation in the Falklands rather than in the other territories. But the figures that David Rogerson took from the published 2021 and 2022 accounts state that the EBITDA for Shure was 48%, still significantly above the benchmarks indicated in 2015. So when people say that they couldn't survive competition and a lowering of the license fee, I'm not sure that matches with the figures, and certainly their reticence to supply figures has been, you know, why would there be reticence if you were fairly comfortable with showing that it would affect your business?
I think one point I would make is I think it's important not to just cherry pick from the 2015 report, because the 2015 report also said that it didn't think that competition would actually work in this small jurisdiction. And it also commented when recommending not for the government not to try to regulate things like return on capital employed and things like that. There were comments that a large telecoms company is also going to expect a certain level of absolute returns, and that's something that also needed to be taken into consideration. So consideration of percentages takes you so far, but you also have to look at the fact that a telecoms company is going to want a minimum absolute return, and that was also part of the consideration, presumably, of the elected members in between 2015 and 2017 when they decided to negotiate the agreement they did.
Mark and then Teslin.
Sorry, Chair. After the answer from the Attorney General, I would have preferred to been able to sort of just chase up on the question that I initially asked. I think unfortunately there was a bit missing from the answer, which is probably my fault for asking such a lengthy question. But I think my second part of the question was whether or not there was any mechanism through which the claims of the high profit margins foreshore can be publicly verified or not. I think we've all heard through the oral evidence, we've heard through written or seen through written evidence and anecdotally across the community for many years about the high profit margin that shore take. Now, my question is to the regulator whether or not this is sort of verified in any way by the regulator. What information can be verified? What can be supplied? What can't be, what is commercially in confidence? So if I could get an answer to that side as well,
Please,
Chair.
So there is an amount of information that is provided that is commercially confidential that I can't share by law with the Select Committee. However, what I would say is the regulatory regime that was developed between 2015 and 2017 doesn't specifically look to regulate profit margin. It doesn't look at profit margin. So what was put in place, for example, was a broadband obligation under which Shure committed to keep packages at particular prices and develop those packages, and that subsequently has moved on. And then there's also a price control mechanism for many of the other regulated services. And what the price control mechanism does is limit the company's ability to increase its prices. It looks at information on cost. It looks at things like the RPI. There is a discount value that's sort of put in there to try and constrain price increases, and that's the way it's been looked at. And to be fair, Shure always provide the data that is requested of them in terms of the price cap, and they have always complied overall with their price cap and their broadband obligation. So in fact, actually, there's nearly always a sum carried forward where Shure could have increased its prices more than they ever actually have done during the period of the licence. And there is still a quite a significant sum carried forward at the moment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Tizen.
Thank you, Chair. Just on your comment about cherry picking from the 2015 report, I mean, I do think that's fair, because there wasn't also the recognition or the expectation that SpaceX would be producing the product that it is. And so in itself, I'd say that report doesn't also accommodate a full view of competition, because technology has moved on quite a lot in those 9 years, and it's continuing on a trajectory which it is obviously of a concern to the Select Committee that Falkland Islands legislation isn't currently able to keep pace with. But I suppose there is also a question there. I mean, you're talking about the information that's being provided by Shore, about what more accurate analysis could be done for us to have a proper view about that. And that may be a question more for Becky later to offer a view on from an FIG perspective. Forewarn. But in terms of the regulator's role, just as a point of clarification, well, a couple of points of clarification, if I may, because certainly I remember at the last meeting of the Select Committee, when Roma was giving her evidence from Shore, there was an expression that Shore were in communication with FIG on a number of different matters. But as you've outlined there are certain matters that the regulator yourself can't share with FIG. So I think there possibly needs to be a bit of an explanation about what is communication with FIG, what is communication with MLAs, what is communication with the regulator, and the separations, and why they are in the way that they are there, so that there isn't any confusion, particularly from the holder of the exclusive license, that when they talk to the regulator that they're talking to FIG or to MLAs, because we need to be sure that the information that we request is also being handed over, and that claiming that it's been shared with the regulator, that is not sharing it with FIG.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a range of mechanisms for communication between the various different groups. So I think SHUA do meet periodically with members of the Legislative Assembly. There definitely are conversations routinely with government officers, and I'm sure the Director of Development and Commercial Services will can talk about that as well. So both she and the Chief Executive have meetings with SHUA. And then there are regular scheduled meetings with the regulator. Now, the regulatory meetings generally focus on the areas that are directly relevant to the sort of regulatory function. So we discuss things such as complaints, faults, we discuss the price cap, any KPIs or quality of service matters and issues in relation to that. So those are the sorts of things that we routinely discuss, some of which, you know, involve the sharing of confidential information which can't be shared more widely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Gavin, do you have a question?
Not so much a question, just something I want to return to that's been going around my mind for a while. I actually find, I find the lack of data or financial figures being supplied to this committee extremely, extremely worrying and bothering, because it stops us from doing any form of detailed financial modelling to find out what the effect of what the petitioners are asking for might be. We are almost navigating slightly blind here, and you know, I would ask that is there any way that perhaps that some sort of some of that information could be supplied?
Well, I mean, in terms of things like, so, I mean, as I say, I get a range of detailed information as part of the price cap submissions, and I absolutely am barred by law from sharing that. That is absolutely unequivocal. I cannot share that with you. And I'm afraid I'm not committing offences for the purposes of the committee. However, I think one of the things that I think I read, I think I'm right in saying I read this in Shure's letter to the committee, that one of the things they suggested is that there may be an ability to share more information with the government if the government is then going to propose to negotiate or discuss some of the issues arising out of this. And it may be that some of that information is considered at that different stage, if you like, than at this stage. Otherwise, I think you are reliant on publicly accessible information, including things like filed accounts, which obviously the I think the latest filed accounts relate to the 2022. Yes, it's not. I think the next accounts aren't to be filed for another month or two.
I'd just like to come back on that for me, Simon. I thank you for your reply, and I certainly would never ask you to step over that line. But so I think, you know, from what you've said and my understanding of what I've heard in this committee so far, I shall draw my own conclusions, and I will have to draw my own conclusions about what a move or the abolition or lowering of the licence fee may have.
Chairman, just to come, I think one other point it's probably just worth just emphasising there in terms of information that is available. I mean, obviously you have seen what in their letter to you, Starlink have indicated they would offer package sizes. Now, of course, that's not a commitment that they would, of course. And you can see what that compares to in terms of SHUA package sizes. And I think, as I say, anecdotally, you know, if you look at the numbers of customers, I think there's inevitably going to be some impact, and you're going to have regard to that, you know, the potential impact there.
Tessa, you had a follow-up.
Thank you. Yeah, and in follow-up to that, so I share a similar frustration with my colleague MLA Short, but I'm more concerned, obviously, given your position as the regulator, as to whether it means that FIG is slightly impeded in fulfilling its role to support telecoms under the exclusive license if we've got data blind gaps, essentially, and does that, in your mind as a regulator, does that highlight any issue or concern that there is an inadequacy in the law to allow for a full and frank exchange of information so that investments from an FIG side can be targeted appropriately?
Well, I mean, I think some of these points are probably more for sort of government to respond. I mean, I was involved to a degree in some of the discussions around the subsidies a few years back, and so in relation to that, just as an example, I am aware that the then chief executive and then director of development and commercial services were absolutely sat next to and formed part of Shua's procurement exercise to procure additional satellite capacity, and was involved in the discussions around that. So I think they travelled up to Guernsey for that process. So we absolutely had sight of the real numbers, the real tender submissions that were coming in from the satellite operators such as Intelsat, and could then make an informed choice at the time about the broadband subsidy that was then agreed, and effectively that subsidy, as I understand it, was designed almost as a pass through. You know, we could see the costs that say Intelsat were going to be charging, and the government could decide how much it was prepared to pay to increase the overall sort of satellite capacity coming into the island.
Thank you. Thank you for the response on that. And I agree, it's possibly similar. A question for FIG to answer in terms of the scoping and data behind investments that FIG have made. They're obviously significant, but I suppose it does sit in the background as a bit of a concern for us as legislators if we need to be reassured about this and we need to see this. So it's hopefully that's something we can pull out through the course of this select committee. But in your view as regulator, obviously you're there to regulate telecoms and work to the ordinance, work within the space of the law. So do you think, or is it in your opinion as regulator, that FIG has done everything that it could within the current law to uphold the telecoms of the Falklands, or do you think that there have been missed opportunities from an FIG perspective?
I'm not necessarily sure that there are missed opportunities from an FIG perspective, perhaps from a regulatory perspective. I mean, I'm certainly not going to sit here and claim that the system has worked perfectly. And I think it's also important to bear in mind that, you know, the system that we have resulted from some detailed consideration. I mean, I've certainly read the Cartesian reports, the two reports that were produced in sort of 2015, and some from earlier than that. And, you know, the system that we have was put in place following consideration of those reports and all of the information that they contained, plus the outcome of a negotiation with Shua. And so to some extent, it is what it is. And, you know, that agreement is in place. The regime as it stands is in place. And, you know, we've got to work best we can within that arrangement, unless and until that is changed.
Thank you.
Did you have a question?
I think the questions I had in my head were been partially answered, but I must express frustration in trying to get through this system constructively when we don't have a full set of information. And I'm quite heartened by the fact that perhaps Shaw would be happy to reveal that information to at least government officers, perhaps, so that some indication of the of that essential detail that the you know, relevant people are made aware of it. And I'd also, you know, the obvious frustration that for the last decade probably the internet services in the Falklands haven't fulfilled the reasonable expectations of the people that are paying for.
Yeah, I think one thing, I mean, I think, you know, we all get frustrated from time to time. I'm not a very great internet user in terms of, you know, I don't do online gaming and things like that, so I probably don't feel the same frustrations that some of the Youth Parliament members feel. I do think it's important to recognise, though, the improvements that have occurred, and actually those improvements have probably occurred in, you know, in large part due to the license that, that those who negotiated it agreed in 2017, and then the subsequent investments by the government, and to be fair, also to investments by Shure. You know, I think if you look at how things have changed throughout the period of the license, there have been huge changes. So, you know, as I say, the bottom package offered by Shure, the price is lower now than it was in 2015. In fact, actually, the price continued to drop, you know, from 2010 onwards. It has dropped down from around £25 a month to £15 a month. And the data allowances are, you know, considerably higher than that. So I think it's important not to, you know, I get that there are frustrations and people want to move on, and other parts of the world have moved on, but I do think it's important to recognise that there have been huge improvements made over the period of the
license. I think
it's
the speed of those improvements. But
well,
what I'd like
to be
to
fair,
ask,
Chairman, sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, I think one of the things that the Cartesian report, I think it said, as well, is, you know, they estimated that the Falkland Islands was probably a few years behind, you know, the rest of the world in some of these technologies, and probably that was, you know, something that we had to accept effectively. That was a reasonable thing to expect, given that we are in a remote location.
I wondered if you can advise why the exclusive license to Shure includes the exceptions of FIG, self-provision, etc., listed under the ordinance, but makes no reference to the license fee for self-provision, given that Shure, in their submission, say this was a central feature of their negotiations for a for an exclusive license.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of different points there. Why were there some exclusions? And I think that was borne out of some concerns, and also concerns about legalities of completely restricting that. There were some concerns at the time, but it's also part of the negotiation there. So why were the exclusions included? I think they were included as a sort of backstop to, you know, where there are circumstances where the exclusive licensee was absolutely not providing. Why then were the fees and things, if they were so critical, not within the license? Well, it's because that's not the right place for those fees to be set. Clearly, the license was agreed with Shure on the basis of a policy decision that the government had made, and then the government subsequently implemented that policy decision by making the fees regulations that they did. Now, there was a bit of a lag in that all happening, but the fees regulations were eventually made in 2019 in accordance with the policy commitments that the government had made in 2016. So, you know, why was that not within the license? Well, it's setting those fees. The license is not the right place for those fees to be set. They need to be set by regulations under the ordinance.
Thank you. I think that separation is actually really helpful to note. Just on a point that you made there around the expectations in 2015, and I accept that maybe in 2015, on the back of the Cartesian report, as you note, there was that expectation that the Falklands could be behind the rest of the world based on its geographical isolation. I would say that is certainly challenged now, and from a consultant who came over to give a presentation to do with hydrocarbons finance earlier in the year, acknowledging that he has set up a tourism business in the deepest, darkest parts of the Amazon and is able to use internet in a way that is better than the Falklands currently have access to through the use of Starlink. I'd say that it's not a reasonable expectation to use geographical location in modern times, and that kind of, to me, it feels like it points to inadequacy in the future proofing of the law, which would have been very difficult. In hindsight, it's a brilliant thing to have acknowledged that would have happened in 2015.
Yeah. I mean, hindsight is marvellous, but in 2015 they did recommend that we look to implement a mid-Earth orbit satellite solution, which the government chose not to do.
Well, there were efforts made there, I can imagine, but the scope of not knowing where technology would take us and the possibility of dial-to-cell technology being on the horizon is also something that would have been very difficult to have predicted. But I would also argue that's why the exclusive license is in perpetuity and that it needs obvious review points, and that's something that our law does clearly reflect. My question, though, is more to do with geographical location and expectations of service. And I know that I've sent you some information about this, so you know where I'm going to be going with this. But we had a kind of third-person communication around some of the services when they went off at Albemarle earlier in the year. And you were quoted by the FIG directorate that at no point has there been a commitment to provide island-wide coverage. And I think you may have been speaking about the mobile service and not only the Wi-Fi. So please could you outline in your view, before I move on to my next question, what is the captured view on the maintenance and repair of Wi-Fi systems in camp, as well as, you know, what expectations for modernisation and resilience of an efficient service there are under the current exclusive licence?
Just taking one step back, is it worth just sort of going through what the commitments actually are in terms of coverage, etc., and then pick up the sort of later point?
Thank you. I mean, that would be really helpful. It's just it's useful to know what camp users
should be able to expect. Absolutely. So the universal service obligation set out in section 34 of SHER's exclusive license, which is largely published. It's certainly on the regulator website. If anyone wishes to read it, there are just a few small areas which have been sort of redacted from publication because of the what they contain. But section 34 sets out the universal service obligation. So fixed telephone and internet services are to be provided essentially to all business and residential premises which are occupied for 6 months or more each year, and they're to be served at effectively the same retail prices as all other, you know, parts of the islands, and, you know, residents in Stanley. So effectively, just because you're in a remote location doesn't mean that SHER should charge you more for your broadband packages. So that does mean then that, you know, there are some places which are not occupied for more than 6 months of the year where there actually isn't an obligation to provide any service, and there isn't an obligation to provide it on the same terms. Now, I think in some of those cases, SHER is actually continuing to do that, but there are some where they're not obliged to do that. In terms of mobile phone coverage, because again, I think some of the things that you were discussing were around sort of safety issues and access to remote sort of areas. And in terms of mobile service, this is referenced in various different parts of the exclusive license. It's in section 41, and then in one of the annexes there are KPIs 13, 14 and 15 which set out which, you know, various mobile sites that were committed to be provided, which SHER met its commitments to do that. Then subsequently there was a contract in, I think, 2021 where the government contracted with SHER to install some additional masts, and again it met those obligations. But what I was referring to in the bit that you quoted is there's never been at any point agreement to full geographic coverage of the islands, and I actually doubt that that would be practical, and certainly not practical in economic terms in relation to the capital and revenue investments to provide mobile coverage for the full geographic area. As part of its arrangement, SHER has committed to modernisation of infrastructure, so I know that there has been work done seeking to improve the camp network. Now, I think that has gone, shall we say, slower than expected, but there have been improvements made there.
Thank you. So, and that is really helpful, I think, for the committee to hear. And while I appreciate there may be no full geographic commitments, farms and businesses that are certainly operating more than 6 months of the year out there are still suffering from extended delays. And as you point to, my point is one of safety as well as business and economic. You know, a full communications blackout in an area is incredibly dangerous, particularly if you've got small children, particularly if you're operating heavy machinery, or, you know, you're at a vulnerable age. Then there are also a number of circumstances that you can't prepare for, but having communication is an essential part for the whole Falklands. Certainly, and it also highlights to me that there is a gap around, and while it's great that SHER are providing services to houses that aren't occupied more than 6 months in the year, and fulfilling those commitments over and above, that points to another inadequacy in our current communications ordinance, that we should be thinking a little bit more about communications as an option for everyone to be able to access. So that's perhaps something that this committee can look to work on. I'd say that there's a very strong case for self-provision that's outlined by some of the safety and business impacts that are caused by permanent outages. Do you think, you know, arguments for self-provision and for that to be at a more affordable level, and to use the words that were highlighted by the Youth Parliament earlier, I think it was by young Harry, that it creates a barrier to some businesses. Affordability is creating a barrier to businesses and to families to be able to access speeds for internet that they need, particularly in camp. I'd say there's also that safety element that comes alongside that. Do you think that in any way, in your view as regulator, highlights the need for affordable VSAT connection?
I think the one thing is, you know, when you just picking on your last point there in terms of affordability, there's always going to be an affordability divide, because even the services that, you know, you're talking about here in terms of VSAT provision, they're not cost free, and there are still, you know, large numbers of families in the islands who will not be able to afford those services. And I think this is where I go back to it. You know, if there is a desire to look at, say, the licence fee, I think you have to go back and look at the 2016 policy rationale, because that's what informed the decision on the fee. Now, what you would need to do is come to a position where you felt that policy rationale no longer held and a different policy rationale applied. And that's the sort of thing that you would need to look at.
Sorry, I've just noticed, Chair, and I apologise for taking up quite a lot of the questioning, but an element of my question there that hasn't been answered was around maintenance and resilience of services, because obviously, to use the Albemarle example, when all services go down and you've got one service provider that needs to come to maintain and bring back online all of those, that creates a resilience issue. And my point about affordability, I do take the point, although we did have an exchange on that earlier, that it may also be around the quality of the product for the price, which is also a factor in thinking about the barrier of affordability. But another point that was made by Brian Jameson in the previous Select Committee was around the speed and maintenance of services, which, when we're talking about that resilience option, is also a very pressing concern. So whether, in your view as regulator, are the needs of the people currently being met, if there is an option there for better maintenance, improved resilience, and for a product that can deliver speeds at, you know, maybe not for free as you've outlined, and still with a price, but is at least delivering a quality of product for the price.
In terms of maintenance, obviously SHUA does have service standards, and that is one of the things that we do discuss in some of the regulatory meetings. And I know, but it's really incumbent on people, if they're unhappy with the service that they've received, to complain. And you know, we really need to see those formal complaints.
I would actually say that isn't the petition a great sign of how unhappy people are with the service? I mean, I think 2,460 signatures or whatever is a pretty clear statement that people are not happy with the service and provision that is being provided at the moment.
And it's difficult to complain if you've
very
only
difficult
got one
to,
option
to dispute that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, a large number of people are unhappy that the grass is greener, as they would see it elsewhere.
Jack.
Thank you, Simon. In the submission from Starlink, where they mentioned that they're around applying for a licence, how they'd like to, but were previously told they were not able to, and I know we did get a bit of clarification from them at a previous meeting.
At no point have Starlink been told that they could not apply for a licence. No. That is absolutely untrue.
That's okay. I just wanted to, I sort of linking to that point, and a
what,
point
what I have
you
said
made
to
in your your submission, if you could just expand on the communication you've had with them.
So I've communicated with Starlink certainly over the past sort of 6 months or so. What I've said to them, I mean, obviously there is an exclusion from the exclusivity in the insurer's license. That must be able to be to be activated. Some individuals have applied for, and I have granted VSAT licenses to those individuals and businesses. They must be able to receive that service. Now, I think from a sort of purist perspective, I do think that Starlink ought to have a regulatory approval to offer those services, but I do think there's a respectable argument that perhaps they don't need to have that, and therefore, since we've never previously required a VSAT license operator to obtain a license, nor any satellite phone operator to obtain a license, I've kept with the status quo unless and until a court decides otherwise. So what I've said to Starlink is, if they want to consider applying for a license, get in touch and we'll discuss what that process might be. Now, I'd certainly envisage that that wouldn't be challenge-free, but we would be able to discuss what that process might be. But I've also said to them that if they wish to continue to provide services to customers who have a VSAT license, I have absolutely no objection at the moment to them continuing to do that. They haven't actually responded in the last 6 months since I started writing to them about the issue of applying for a regulatory approval. They've simply not taken that forward.
Okay.
Thank you.
John, did you have an
idea?
Nope. No. Leona, did you have something?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, it's actually taking a step back. Sorry, I was trying to indicate earlier. But on the monitoring of data and performance, I know that quality of service reports are made available, I think, to the regulator. But Simon, could you talk through what the regulator does receive and what those reports show, because I think, you know, recognizing absolutely the conversation that just happened about people must report faults, otherwise they don't appear. I think, and I made this point to Roma when she was giving a short submission at the last select committee, that I think, you know, people have largely given up reporting faults, which is not helpful in terms of monitoring. The question to me is about being able to have confidence that Shaw can deliver what they're required to, and that they can bring about improvements in the future. And I think that's one of the huge frustrations that's felt across the community, is that confidence the upgrades and the tempo that we need would actually be there for all the obvious economic, social, safety reasons, all those things that have been discussed. But can you talk us through the gathering and monitoring of performance data?
Yeah, so there are KPIs that are currently in place, and sure, each quarter provides data, although, you know, actually we meet periodically, and basically at every meeting there's normally some conversation around, you know, complaints, data, things that are happening, etc. But in terms of the formal reporting, there's report on KPIs quarterly. It looks at faults, and it looks at it, you know, both in Stanley and in camp. It looks at residential. It looks at business. It looks at how long the company is taking to repair faults, etc. So we get data around that. We get data around reliability, in terms of network outages and things like that, planned and unplanned. We receive data around complaints. So the numbers of complaints, the resolution of complaints, and there's obviously a targets that are set, some of which are met, and some of which occasionally are not met, and we discuss those, and we discuss the reasons why things are have either been met or not met, and then determine whether there's any action to be taken.
Chair, may I please ask a follow-up question? So I think it's regulatory principle B that outlines that the needs of the people of the Falkland Islands are the paramount consideration in the operating of the licence regimes under the ordinance. Building on Leona's question there, do you think there is currently too much obligation on the consumer to report faults? Because certainly from the testimony that we heard from the young people earlier, minor faults, which maybe is a broad term and probably needs some definition behind it, but, you know, not meeting speed requirements, having to wait 20, 30 minutes for a page to load, that's a fault. But if they're daily occurrences, routine occurrences happening several times a day, that's placing quite a lot of obligation on consumers across the whole Falklands to report those faults, as well as what might be considered a more major fault in people's minds, such as a complete outage of service.
Can I just give an example? I mean, I think one of the things that the constant negative communication around this issue, I think, has an impact on people. So just an anecdote from this week, an actual case from this week that someone I was speaking to, their internet was not functioning as they had expected, and was, you know, they just had assumed, as everyone says, this is a terrible service, so we just have to live with it. I said, no, if there's a fault, report it. And they got back to me within a couple of hours and said, actually, we reported it to Shure. There was a fault on the line, they fixed it, and it's working much, much better. It's really important, if things aren't working, for people to actually report that, because there are faults. Faults do occur, and then Shure can fix them where it's a fault that's causing the problem. Now, there are some problems that are caused by the overall constraints of supply and what people are wanting to do, but there are some where there is a fault on the line, and they need to be able to have the opportunity to fix that. So that was a case this week where someone was just going to be sat there resigned to the fact that their internet was not working as they'd sort of expected it to. They reported a fault. There was a fault on the line. It was fixed, and things began working as they expected it to.
My question was, do you think that puts too much obligation on the consumer? Because certainly from the petition and the point was made by the chair earlier, I don't think having to report faults, whether it's on a daily or weekly basis, is a reasonable expectation for a consumer.
How can Shure fix a fault if they don't know about it?
If the fault is the speed across the islands, it's difficult.
Well,
to resolve.
I mean, that's not a fault. That's just a limitation of the contractual arrangements that are in place.
I mean, I'd just like to say, I mean, you know, do you have a view if, given the strength of public feeling demonstrated by the petition and the communications objectives, particularly, it would be in the public interest to prosecute individuals self-providing, given that the needs of the people of the Falklands are the paramount consideration in operating the licensing regimes under this ordinance. The unreliability and quality of particularly camp telecommunications, and I think this is evidenced by compensation that's being paid to various people in the camp in this current month, are surely a major consideration, aren't they?
Yeah, so I think there's a number of points there. One, I think I can't simply ignore non-compliance with the law and the currently approved policies of the government. So, the policy rationale, approved in 2016 is what we're charged with delivering, and I can't simply ignore that position. I think it would be inappropriate to try and make a general statement about a sort of public interest consideration. Every individual case, if there's an investigation undertaken, would be considered on its own individual merits. If there was any suggestion that someone was to be prosecuted, the same test would be applied as is applied for every other case. There's an evidential test. Is there enough evidence to provide a realistic prospect of conviction? And then there's a public interest test. Is it in the public interest for that matter to go ahead? I think the fact of the petition is of extremely little weight in that sort of balancing exercise. You know, give another example. If there was a petition saying the speed limit on the MPC road should be increased to 70 miles an hour, and everyone agreed that petition, does that mean that someone driving at 65 miles an hour wouldn't or shouldn't face prosecution when the speed limit, the lawful speed limit, remained at 40 miles an hour? I would suggest the petition would carry almost no weight in that assessment. absolutely, we understand what people feel about this issue, but that needs to be addressed by the policies and the contractual arrangements that are in place.
Thanks. Gavin?
I was just going to make a point that a wise legal person some years ago once said to me that really laws are consensual. The public has to agree to abide by those laws. If there is a mass rise up against any sort of law, then it means that law really is useless. You know, if the public finds that is really, they do not wish to be governed by a certain law, and if you have enough people saying the same thing, then perhaps that law is not fit for purpose.
But then we have a representative democracy here, where it, you know, if laws are felt not to meet the needs of the community, there are processes by which laws can be changed. But I think we also have to remember that there are contractual commitments engaged here as well, and the, you know, a license has been issued on terms agreed with SHUE, and that, you know, we need to have recognition of that. I think it would be it would not be a great thing for society if everyone felt that they didn't need to be bound by contracts that they had entered into.
And I believe this was a question put by the chair. Thank you for the response, because this select committee would also like to understand very clearly what parts are enshrined in the law, what's covered in the contractual commitments, and what, and as you've said, the fees, which are outlined more in policy decisions from what I can tell.
The fee is the VSAT licence fee is currently set in the fees regulations that were made in 2019. The rationale for why the fee was set at the level it was set at it derives from the policy that was agreed in I think it was October 2016 as part of that sort of licensing regime. I think it would be certainly well worth members looking at if they haven't already. I think it's Annex B to the report that went to Executive Council. I think it's published on the website, so anyone can see that report and that annex, and that sets out why. And I think, you know, one of these issues that we've talked about is public interest. Well, you know, there's the interests of members of the public who wish to have access to Starlink services. There are also broader interests, and you know, we've talked about digital divide, we've talked about, you know, services that are not necessarily in themselves economic, and the need for cross subsidy. The public interest in this regard is really a broader public interest that needs to be considered, not simply the interests around this particular issue.
Thank you. And I think, as I outlined to you in email, I personally don't believe that arguments for sacrifice of service to a minority of people fully uphold, for a majority of people fully uphold, the needs of the people of the Falklands. I think there is certainly a conversation to be had there around interest versus needs, because certainly as we see different parts of the country continue to suffer from faults or young people being unable to access educational opportunities, the needs of the Falklands are currently not what are being supported. So but thank you for your evidence.
I mean, I think from my perspective, a negotiated solution is the best way to proceed with this. But obviously, members will take their own views on that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, since the government policy originally was set, SHORE are now in receipt of substantial subsidy, which they didn't have in 2016. Plus, they have the advantages of economies of scale over self-provision. Can the regulator advise why, with those advantages, the economies of scale? I mean, we know how much they're spending in camp. It's not that much. I've got some figures that I think I've provided on the Select Committee website from SHORE. So, with those advantages, why aren't they able to compete with self-provision without a penal licence fee?
Well, I think there's a few things. One, remember that Starlink as a company has lost billions and billions of dollars in putting thousands of satellites into orbit. I think it is now a profitable revenue generating business, but it has spent billions of dollars to get to that point. And those costs are not currently being passed on effectively to their subscribers, you know, here, you know, so they've got a much greater economy of scale that they're able to absorb that. Shure has to deliver a range of services in addition to internet, and it has to deliver them to a wide range of areas where it requires physical infrastructure to be put in place. And I think in terms of the subsidy, as I say, I'm not sure that the subsidy is particularly, you know, relevant to this particular question, because what that subsidy is doing is paying for extra satellite capacity that otherwise wouldn't be paid for out of Shure's revenues.
Just one more as well. The regulator's price control paper stated that there was going to be a new price regime brought in from 1st January 2024, and that there was going to be a draft proposal, and then there were going to be discussions of the draft proposal with Shure prior to public consultation with an opportunity for Shure to participate in the manner it wishes to, especially to address criticism or misunderstanding of its pricing policies, price levels and commercial factors influencing price outcomes. I mean, it was very odd that didn't take place and wasn't brought in from the 1st of January. And then suddenly, just the week before we had the Select Committee, Shure brought out a new set of prices. Were those, number one, agreed with the regulator prior to being brought in? And, you know, why was there no proposal progressed in 2023? And have the latest packages put out by Shure been agreed in consultation with the regulator?
Okay, so I think there's a number of things. So when the broadband subsidy was agreed by the government in 2022, so previously, take a further step back, the price cap mechanism that was in place did not cover broadband services. It covers a range of other services, telephony, etc. When the broadband subsidy was agreed in 2022, we anticipated that we would bring broadband services within the price cap regime, and that new price cap would come into effect from the beginning of 2024 and would run until the end of 2027, which is the earliest date on which Shure's license could be brought to an end. So as that previous paper noted, the process was expected to flow from a draft proposal being submitted, ultimately public consultation and setting of the new price cap. So as planned, we commissioned some work actually from Mr. Rogerson, who I know has been providing some advice to the committee. His draft proposals were first discussed, I think, with Shure in August 23, and then we sent them to Shure for some initial consideration. Discussions, I mean, essentially stalled specifically due to concerns about the impact of Starlink and what was going to be the response of the government and of the regulator to the issue of Starlink. And unable we to make progress on that. I mean, I think, you know, the very fact that we're having this select committee, you know, and that there's, you know, certainly suggestions that the license fee be looked at, that creates huge uncertainty. And so what we essentially agreed was that the existing price cap would be rolled forward for a further year. So in other words, for all of 2024. And we would hope that we would be able by the end of this year to have something in place to cover 25, 26 and 27. So as part of that, we agreed with Shure that they would effectively maintain their existing broadband packages. So that was the commitment that was given at the time. So subsequently, they've actually increased the data allowances in those packages. So they certainly consult. I mean, they consulted the government on that, as well as, you know, letting me know as regulator, and the two new packages. Again, I think it formed part of the briefings to a degree that we had in March, when I think the chief executive of the group visited the islands. So there was some discussion there. The actual detailed packages were certainly informed to me prior to implementation, but obviously that's an enhancement of what was the commitment that was given for this year. So there's certainly no issue in relation to that from a regulatory
perspective. It's rather strange though that come last year there was no, they were sticking their feet in the ground, and suddenly just a week before the select committee, they decided to bring out some new packages. Does that not seem strange to you?
Well, I mean, I think those packages have certainly been in discussion for some months. Yeah, but those things have been in discussion for some months. You know, they have not just materialised. I mean, certainly things like the unlimited packages that have been introduced. But, you know, there was discussion about them back in whenever it was.
But March. Also, the agreed process was not followed, which is set out on the regulator's website.
No, and it wasn't because
there
we
was
were
no
unable
public
to
consultation
we were unable
whatsoever.
To no we yeah. were unable to make progress on that because of the whole issue of Starlink. I would very much hope that we are able to make progress by the end of this year.
I would suggest that it's only the issue of Starlink that's meant that there are new packages being brought out. That seems the case just before 1 week before there's a select committee. Gavin or Tesla?
You first, Tesla.
Oh, I don't mind. Thank you. You pointed to David Rogerson. Obviously, he's been providing evidence to this committee, and through some of the public evidence that he's submitted, he seems to agree with your view that a negotiated agreement with Shaw is the route forward. But one of the claims that he makes, and I don't think it's catch you too off guard if I just quote it, but on 3.2 of the draft paper that he's submitted alongside the agenda to this committee, was that there would be social and economic consequences, and consequences for the exclusive licensee's ability to fund other communication services such as fixed lines, mobile, radio and TV should the VSAT license fee be lowered. I think we did speak a little quite extensively about making sure that we've got data available for this committee to be able to understand the impact of that, because that's quite obviously a very impactful statement that he's made. But this current select committee does not have the data available to be able to work through that, or to look at alternative options, or to be able to look at an option for a negotiated settlement currently. So we taking into account that there is obviously commercial information that you can't share,
yeah.
Us as legislators and as a select committee are hampered by our ability to be able to work forward on this issue unless some of that information can be shared.
I mean, it may be that there's some opportunity. I know Roma's sat in the room today. There may be some opportunity for us to look at whether some information could be provided. I mean, I think it would be very helpful for you to know, for example, the proportions of packages that are you know, at the different levels. Now, that then doesn't give you necessarily the detailed financial information, but it does allow you to make an assessment of, well, how many people potentially could decide not to continue with their Shure subscription. Because one of the things that's quite interesting is one or two of the individuals who've applied for and obtained a VSAT license had sort of indicated that they would not be making changes to their Shure subscription if they obtained such a license and then have subsequently done exactly that. So I think you can make a fair assumption that if someone is able to obtain a VSAT license, is able to obtain a service from Starlink, that either all or a significant proportion of their current broadband subscription price would cease to be available to Shure. And so you would be able to at least model the potential drop in revenue if you knew roughly the proportions of people on different packages.
I'd just say that
packages.
We have been provided with numbers of packages and people with packages in the past,
yeah. Yeah.
But what we weren't provided with is the packages like the government package of over £200,000 a year, Stanley Services packages, or what they're paying for, which was over £100,000 a year. So we weren't given a complete picture, and I think that's something that I think would be desirable in the future.
I do think you have to be clear as well, though. You know, the exclusive license deals with certain regulated services. It doesn't deal with absolutely every service that Shure provides. You know, Shure has a retail shop, That's of no interest whatsoever from a regulatory perspective. Shire provides services to businesses, so I mean, you know, they host data centres and things like that. That has nothing to do with any of the regulated services. So I do think we have to be careful that we're looking at the right bits of the business.
We do,
as well.
But I think, as you know, when the licence was first introduced, Shire had to reduce and increase packages over a number of years because of the level of profitability that they had. So unless we understand that level of profitability now, how can we really inform decisions about the level of a fee for using, for utilising self-provision,
yeah,
or how they are doing? So, and once again, their published accounts are showing EBITDA of 48%, which is right up at the level it was when the Cartesian report said that we needed to bring down, or they needed to bring down and increase the packages for the people of the Falklands. I don't think we're doing justice to the people of the Falklands in the way in which we're analysing that data.
Of course, you know, the profit margins for different businesses across the islands are all very different. There are some more profitable businesses, and there are a lot of less profitable businesses.
But this is a monopoly that is supposed to be being regulated. And I think we owe it to the people of the Falklands to look at the figures and they need to have a reasonable return.
Chairman, the regulatory regime, the mechanism for that regulation has been price control, and that has operated as it was intended to operate.
Yeah, and as we know, the technological landscape has changed, and the expectations of the public and of the economy and education and all these other social aspects have also changed, and I think, yeah, that's why the committee is here today, to deal with all this new information and reconcile what the gaps are.
But several things have changed, in that I don't think in 2015 there was nowhere near the level of mobile phone provision. There was nowhere near the level of provision for, say, I'm sure if you looked at government, they probably weren't paying over £200,000 for broadband in 2016, and there was also the subsidy that was brought in.
The costs of providing those services have also changed. So
I agree.
Extra international satellite capacity has been bought to meet those services.
We need to understand the whole picture.
The government has put the electricity price up. I'm sure it's probably quite a big user of electricity.
Yeah.
So you know, there are lots of different changes. Yes,
yes.
No, the unit cost of the data from the satellite providers has certainly dropped considerably,
yes,
which has allowed some of the increases that
have
been put in place.
Which is why we need the facts and the figures.
I'd just like to ask, I should know this, but what date was the Cartesian report published, please?
I think it was 2015, but I'm not sure. But it again, I think there is a published version of that report, which I think is probably still within the Assembly's website. There is also a fuller version of that would potentially be available to members of the Assembly, but hasn't been published.
Yeah, no, I'll just go back to my former point, really, that is barely eligible for consideration, I think, as a factor in our discussions now. It's so out of date in a rapidly changing world. And the, fair enough, we do live a bit on the frontier, we're very isolated, and I think the population of the Falklands have been very tolerant of the, the endeavour of the provider to work under those difficult circumstances. But now there's a clear innovation which has raised the expectation of the people in the Falklands, and I think that must be respected, and it will require compromise, possibly financial compromise.
Yeah, I mean, they call new technologies like this disruptors and disruptive technologies, and they certainly are. And that's what they're aimed to do. Now that does then create challenges to try and incorporate that within a regime that was agreed some years ago.
Gavin,
Thank you, Chair. This has been partially covered by MLA Barkman to my left, but of course we're looking at two things that has been asked for in the petition. And number one there is to abolish or reduce the VSAT license. And I'm certainly not putting words in your mouth, Simon, because you weren't here. I think this comes from the meeting before where there was inference that should we put that to zero or 2 shillings and 6 pence, whatever it may be, customers would be off like herds of wildebeests across the plain towards Skylink. But Starlink. I guess the question I was going to put to you is, even if we reduce that to zero, it's no good old short knocking on your door saying, well, I wouldn't mind this because it's half priced and goes twice or 10 times as quick, because it still has to be filtered through you, does it not? The we can do what we want, or if we did do what we wanted with the license fee, it still has to be filtered through your office every application.
That is the current regime.
I would have to prove my case that, you know, they couldn't supply what I was wanting.
Yeah.
So we couldn't, even if we took off like herds of wildebeests, it would only be to your door and may go no further.
Yes, to a degree. I mean, as I say, that we'd need to have a look at the full sort of policy rationale for that.
Anyone else? Jack, yes.
I just wanted to touch on the submission from Shaw in the previous meeting of this committee, and I think on page 3, sort of halfway down page 3, they start to talk about the VSAT policy and VSAT guidance notes and the policy that was approved in 2016 along with the communications bill. And I just wonder if you could sort of expand on some of the things that they've talked about in that and where they talk about the VSAT policy that was approved that mentions the £5,400 fee, VSAT fee, was a significant factor in them agreeing to the exclusive license. And I just wondered if you could sort of expand on that and whether the fee and the policy attached to the fee is a requirement or a part of their license, or if it is a separate policy. So whether they've talked about them being very much linked, are they, or are they very different things that can be dealt with differently?
I think this is an area that you know is ripe for dispute, and so I think I'd want to be slightly careful in terms of what I would say here. I think what Shaw are arguing is that the agreement of that policy was fundamental to them entering into the contract that they did with the government, which comprises the exclusive license. Now, that is definitely a point of view, and if we fundamentally seek to change that, then there is certainly an argument that they could bring some form of proceedings against the government. But I think that's something that would require very careful consideration. It's absolutely the case that excluded from their licence is VSAT, self-provision. That is excluded from the exclusivity. And it's absolutely the case that it's for the government to set the fee for that and the policy rationale that informs that fee. So if there was a suggestion that should be changed, I think we would certainly need to move very carefully, ensure that we properly consider the provisions within the ordinance around the any change to the fee, and had a very clear policy rationale for any sort of proposed change. Now, that doesn't then mean that there won't be some challenge to that decision, but that, you know, is those things can be done. But there's risk
and
there's risk of the consequences as well as the practical risk of the consequences of that.
But the situation has changed from 2015. It's a different background. You know, with the subsidy, with the move from more in the way of mobile phones, etc. So things have changed.
Yeah.
EBITDA hasn't, but other things have.
I'll not say what I think it was Charlie Munger who has a phrase for what he thinks of EBITDA as a metric.
Well, we don't see any figures. That's one of the problems, I think.
Thank you for that response, though. That's really helpful. I think the separation of the different factors is going to be key to our decision, but we also recognise as a committee that we need to think through the consequences of all those decisions, and that's why certainly timely and quality data is appreciated and hopefully will be a bit more forthcoming from all related agencies so that we can make a wise decision suitable for the needs of the Falklands, which is legislated for, so they need communications.
Okay. Anyone else? Anyone? No? Leona, Mark? No? See Mark, so... No.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very, very much indeed, Simon.
Eating up enough of your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, Becky Clark, thank you very much for coming to give oral evidence today. Did you want to say anything to begin with, or...?
I will just start by saying that... as I understand it, but obviously happy to take direction from the committee, my evidence will largely be related to the broadband obligation agreement, so what we call the broadband contract. There are elements of that in terms of general principles I'm happy to discuss in open session. However, if any of the questions relate to specific provisions or management of the contract, there's a commercial confidentiality attached to that, and I'll have to either decline to answer, or if the session is closed, to only members.
We can go into the closed session.
Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you very much. Good. Who wants to start? Tez, did you have a...
Thank you. I've got a couple of questions, and as you've just acknowledged, if you can give a more complete answer in a closed section, that would be appreciated. But what you can say in a public meeting is also of great importance for the public. So the first is, and I know this was a known issue a few years ago because it was identified in a conversation in the House that we'd had, which is... currently, what data is FIG gathering to ensure that there is proper and adequate monitoring and implementation of our investments, such as the subsidy or such as in infrastructure?
Yep. So the broadband contract, which was signed in 2022, contains a specific provision for SURE to provide promptly relevant information to ensure that the subsidy agreed under that contract is being used for the purposes defined in that contract. Largely, that is being assessed through a series of KPIs which are also attached to that contract as a schedule and which were mutually agreed also in 2022 when the contract was signed. The data that's required depends on which KPIs are being monitored, so some of it's very simple public information: have these things been launched, has this information been provided. Some of it is more complex commercial information to do with where levels of satellite capacity have been provided from and how. So the amount of data and the sort of data we request varies, and it depends on the KPIs. But I can say that the contract management meetings we have, SURE has never failed to provide requested information.
Thank you, Director.
Anyone else? Gavin?
No.
Mark? Leona? Did you have anything? You wanted to ask Becky?
No, not for me, thank you, Chair.
No. Leona? No. Jack? John?
I actually have one.
Good.
Chair.
Okay, so go on, yeah.
So it's known, generally speaking, that all governments have to take a long view, as actually businesses have to take a long view. So can you confirm that the time scale that FIG, in the knowledge that there are just short of 3 years left in the exclusive contract, can you give us any idea of the timescale at which FIG would start working up towards the next, if indeed there was one, next contract?
FIG's already started work on this. So there was a conversation which started with the Technology Development Group, which contains representatives from businesses, communities, and all around the Falklands, to identify a specification for how we approach the next three-year period, to use it as a period for review and establishing of commercial and economic options for after the licence period. The earliest point at which FIG can give notice to SURE is the 1st of January 2026, to come to the end of the contract on the 1st of January 2028. So, as you say, that's pretty much 3 years and a couple of months. The Technology Development Group work led to a public international procurement exercise to find telecommunications consultants to give the support and expertise in the subject matter that FIG just simply doesn't have in-house. There's a paper coming to EXCO next week to consider that. That paper will be commercially confidential at the moment because it pertains to ongoing negotiations and contract terms, but we will certainly, once that's hopefully been approved, be taking that forward with the public. The exercise that we're planning is going to be in two phases, an initial consultation involving consultants coming to the islands, talking with everyone who's interested, as well as some online presence, and then conducting a legal and technical review of the current provisions, the setup. And then second phase is to take all that information and provide FIG with an idea of what the market options look like and to engage in whatever procurement exercises are indicated by that, obviously as approved by Executive Council. So the current timeline for that is it will work through the entirety of 2025. There will be several milestones within that, one of which will be the production of the initial review, the second of which will be a decision by Executive Council on the findings of that review and what direction it wishes to take, and then the third of which will be obviously a public exercise internationally to look at what we might do in the next period. We've not ruled anything in or out for that, so we haven't ruled in or out an exclusive contract, we haven't ruled in or out multiple provision, we haven't ruled in or out splitting the different elements of telecommunication, because it's key to remember this is about all telecommunications aspects, not just the broadband provision. Our intention, although it's an ambitious timescale, so we will push to get there, but our intention is to be in a position by the end of 2025 for Executive Council to be able to make an intelligent and informed decision about what it wants to do in terms of serving notice on the current contracts and licence and how that sort of next phase will look.
Thank you, but you don't have a date for, you say by the end of 2025, it's quite a big year, 2025. You wouldn't be able to give any indication as to what quarter of 2025?
Not at the moment, because we will wait on Executive Council's decision about the appointment of consultants and then work with those consultants on a project plan, which will be passed back to members and made available to the public so that everyone's aware of the timescales when they've been sort of sorted out and we know what's actually practicable.
Thank you very much.
Tesla.
Thank you. Thank you for that insight. That's really incredibly helpful. Obviously, the committee is concerned from a matter of public interest. Obviously, this petition has come forward, but also we are concerned about the lack of data that we've been provided to understand the impact upon other communication services, which are covered by the telecoms exclusive license as well, and how that would be affected should the VSAT fee change. Please can you offer a view to that, as well as from an FIG perspective, please can you offer a view on the consideration of the LEO rollouts and the disruption and quality of service information that has been presented? And from a department's view, please can you offer a view on whether that represents good value for taxpayers' money?
So on the final point, the value for taxpayers' money under the broadband obligation is assessed through the KPIs indicated in that contract. As I said, I can't discuss ongoing contract management issues in the open session, so I'll decline to answer on the specific point in any more detail at this point. But as I previously said, Shure has never not provided the information asked for. In terms of other telecoms provision, that doesn't currently come under an area that I'm responsible for or manage. In terms of the current provision, it is encapsulated into the project I've just outlined to look at telecoms provision after the current exclusive license period ends. When it comes to that process, we've had conversations with Shure about the amount of information that they will be willing and able to provide to our consultants, and that's been a positive conversation, again, because we haven't appointed the consultants yet. We don't have a definitive sort of set of terms, but it's something that we will be working really closely with Shure on to make sure that our consultants have the right information that they need to be able to make just sensible and workable recommendations for the future of the Falklands.
Thank you.
Just, I wondered, do you view that the standard of service of speed and cost of service to consumers has kept pace with international developments? if not, is it not reasonable to allow self-provision when the exclusive provider, who has the advantage of economies of scale, a large government subsidy of around £1 million per annum, plus large contracts with FIG worth over £200,000 per annum for broadband, has failed to provide an up-to-date service, given the monopoly was set up to ensure the best possible service to all consumers, and particularly, you know, as regards LEO, which was supposed to provide a step change in speed that from last December. What's your opinion on that?
I have not got the expertise to offer an opinion on international provision of telecoms. I can speak to the current levels of provision in terms of the broadband obligation contract. And what I would say is, and I echo in this some of what the regulator previously said, Shaw has complied with what was asked of them, with the exception of the introduction of the LEO services, which is a contract management matter. With that exception, Shaw has in fact exceeded the amount of bandwidth they were required to provide under the broadband obligation. And again, as the regulators previously mentioned, has introduced packages in advance, enhanced from what was required under the price controls of the broadband obligation. I think one of the understandable frustrations with this process is that members of the public and others looking at this have always wanted to look at a sort of direct cost comparison. Whereas in fact, the way that it has been contracted for and is regulated, it's about what Shaw puts in to the Falklands rather than what they take out of it, if that makes sense. In terms of what we have required them to do, those requirements, with the exception of the introduction of LEO services, have been met.
Thank you. Anyone else? Question?
I suppose just to thank you for your time, but also if I think a closed session would be useful to understand in a little bit more detail some of these more sensitive areas.
Yeah.
So perhaps we should draw to a close, and then perhaps would you mind staying on?
I'm very happy to stay.
Have some time just to have a closed session. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming today. Thanks to everybody that took part. Hopefully it's been informative. Thank you.